Welcome to the High and Inside Podcast, episode 103. I am your host, Joel Walker. Let me go ahead and talk about this week's baseball fun fact. This one is about the great or greatest player ever, Hank Aaron. But did you know that Hank Aaron played more seasons in Milwaukee than he did in Atlanta? He played 14 seasons in total with Milwaukee and 9 seasons in Atlanta. Now remember, two of those seasons with Milwaukee were in 1975 and 1976, his last two seasons, and they were with the Brewers. So something maybe you don't think about, I just never really thought about it, and kind of a little bit outweighed with the Milwaukee numbers compared to the seasons in Atlanta, but I thought that was a little interesting. Something I want to talk about in this episode is I really want to go back and highlight a Braves player and one of the seasons that this player had. And this week I want to talk about Marquise Grissom. Marquise Grissom played with the Braves for only two seasons, but the year I want to discuss is the 1996 season. And that was his second season with the Braves and his final season too before he was traded off with David Justice to the Indians for Kenny Lofton and what some Braves fans might consider one of the worst Braves trades. And I was in complete shock when I saw that that trade had happened. That was really before internet was happening. And I remember going to a gas station and seeing the newspaper, the AJC, and it seems like it was probably on the front page that trade had happened, and I was just shocked. But let's go back to the final season Marquise Grissom was here, and that was 1996. He batted .308. He had 207 hits, 23 home runs, 74 RBI, and 28 stolen bases. He would actually finish 13th in the NL MVP voting, and he would win his third Gold Glove that year in the outfield. Now let's look at his performance in the 1996 World Series against the Yankees. He did really well also in 95 in the World Series, but he performed really well in 96 once again. But unfortunately, we know the Braves lost that World Series to the Yankees in 6 games and with a team that really should have won. And, you know, it's a pain. It's hard to just go back and realize that they didn't win that. But Marquise batted .444 and really had a good series there against the Yankees. But .444, he had 12 hits and 27 at-bats with 5 RBI. And I think he only struck out maybe 2 times in those 27 at-bats. But the guy was really just a great performer, a great athlete, and a guy that I really missed when they traded him. And, of course, I missed David Justice, who went on to have a really good season in 1997 with the Cleveland Indians. And we got that one year of Kenny Lofton, and he was back to Cleveland. So here's the other thing I want to talk about. We know Bobby Cox, obviously, as the manager, but I want to talk about before he managed and maybe some of the stuff you don't really know about, and I'm just going to kind of talk about it briefly, but before they managed with Bobby Cox this week. And I might talk about some other managers going forward just to kind of highlight what they did, whether it was just in the minors or in the major leagues, and just talk about it because sometimes with these great managers or managers, we don't know much about their previous playing history. So with Bobby Cox, he was originally signed by the Dodgers in 1959. In 1964, he was drafted by the Cubs from the Dodgers in what is called the 1964 minor league draft, which I believe is pretty much like the Rule 5 draft, or it's the same thing. So in 1966, he was then traded by the Chicago Cubs with cash to the Atlanta Braves for Billy Cowan. In 1967, he was traded by the Atlanta Braves to the New York Yankees for Del Roberts and Bob Tillman. Now, fun fact about Bob Tillman, his first major league hit was actually a home run. So Bobby Cox would play 2 seasons for the New York Yankees in 1968 and 1969 as a third baseman. In 628 plate appearances, he batted .225, 9 home runs, and 58 RBI. so not really killing it with a bat. So after being released in 1971, he began managing in the Yankees minor league system. And after several years in the minors, he was hired by the Yankees' first base coach in 1977. And who was the manager for the Yankees in that 1977 season? It was Billy Martin. So Bobby Cox was the first base coach for Billy Martin. And the Yankees won the World Series in 1977, which would be Bobby Cox's first World Series championship. It wasn't as a player, it wasn't as a manager, it was as a coach. In 1978, he would be hired to manage the Atlanta Braves for his first stint with the team as the manager. Some of you guys, some of you newbies may not realize Bobby Cox managed with the Braves, was fired by Ted Turner, managed the Blue Jays, and then came back to the Braves originally as the general manager, and then put himself in as the manager with John Schuerholz coming on as the GM to set up many years of success in Atlanta. Now, an interesting fact about his only two seasons playing in the MLB was his first year playing with the Yankees would be the last year of Mickey Mantle's career in 1968. So he played in Mickey Mantle's last season with the Yankees. In 1969 would be the first year, though, for another Yankees legend who was gone too soon, but Thurman Munson. So he caught the end of one legendary career and caught the beginning of another legendary career with the Yankees. So speaking of managers, something that we'll probably never see again is a player manager. And the last person to do that is Pete Rose. The Pete Rose that's not in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, that Pete Rose. So I want to kind of look out. I titled this, How I Manage Myself. How did Pete Rose manage and play, and what did that look like? And I'm just going to kind of talk about his stats and how he performed and what brought him into management with the Reds. Now, Pete Rose would manage the Reds from 1984 to 1989, and he would manage to a record of 412 wins, 373 losses. So he actually managed with a winning record, really not bad, but he would start the 1984 season as a player with the Expos, just as a player. So then the Expos on August 16th, 1984 would trade Pete Rose to the Reds. And once he was traded to the Reds during the season, the Reds immediately named him the manager of the team because he took over for the manager, which was Vern Rapp, who was just fired. And he would play and manage for the remaining 1984 season, the 1985 and 1986 season. So in 1985, he would play in 115 games. And in 1986, he would play in 72 games. So you can see that just because he's managing, you know that he's up there in age, because those three seasons that he was doing both when he came back to the Reds, you're talking about his 43, 44, and 45 age, career. Those are numbers not many people reach in the age department still playing. And he didn't really perform as well as he did. So you kind of look at those numbers and think, well, he obviously knows this, and he can split time with someone else. And so he's obviously on the decline of his playing career. Rose would play first base, and like I said, he was split time with another Reds legend in Tony Perez. In 85, Tony played 50 games at first, and in 207 plate appearances, he batted .328. He struck out 22 times and walked 22 times. He made two errors with a .995 fielding percentage. So that's Tony Perez. So you compare this to Pete Rose. Rose played 110 games at first. In 501 plate appearances, he batted .264, but he only struck out 35 times and walked 86 times. So you still see that he's a good hitter. He's not striking out that often. 35 times in 501 plate appearances is really good. So at first, that's first base this is, he made five errors with a .995 fielding percentage, which is the same fielding percentage as Tony. He would manage the team to an 89-72 record. Now, let's go to 1986. He would play in 72 games. So just because he's the manager, he's not going to put himself in every game. Obviously, you can see here, he only played 72 games. And his batting average would dip down to 219 in 272 plate appearances. And once again, that season, he split time with Tony Perez. And he would manage the team in 1986 to a 86-76 record. On November 11th, 1986, something interesting happened. And I wonder what kind of conflict, if any, that this could have caused with Pete Rose. But he was actually dropped from the Reds' 40-man roster to make room for a pitcher. So he officially, or unofficially, I should say, unofficially retires as a player. But he kept managing, and we know how that ended. So I thought that'd be interesting to kind of take a look at Pete Rose, the manager player, and what he did, not really playing himself, but, you know, had a little bit of success as a manager. A segment I've done in the past was an up for debate, and in the past I did it about Randy Johnson and Roger Clemens and who should have won a Cy Young that season, and it was Roger Clemens, and looking at the stats, it should have been Randy Johnson. Now, this one goes back quite a bit. It's back in 1963. It's called Up for Debate, the 1963 National League MVP. I'm going to talk about the top five guys. I'm not going to go over every stat with these guys, but the winner of the 1963 NL MVP was Sandy Koufax. And first, let me tell you the order of the top five. And if I don't pronounce a couple of these guys, or one of these guys' names right, I apologize, but I'm not really familiar with him. Number one, Sandy Koufax. Number two, Dick Groat. Three, Hank Aaron. Four, Ron Peronoski, I believe. And number five is Willie Mays. Now, what's crazy right here is I'm going to talk about the WAR, wins above replacement. Sandy Koufax had a 9.9 WAR. Groat was 7.1. Hank Aaron was 9.1. Ron was 4.5, yet somehow he was right above Willie Mays, who had a 10.6 WAR, the highest of all five of those guys. Now, Groat, I believe, Groat was more of just an average hitter. Like, he hit for average. He wasn't a power hitter, anything like that. He batted 319. And you could compare that to Hank Aaron batting 319, Willie Mays batted 314, and Ron was a pitcher. He was more of a relief pitcher. And let's just go ahead and say right now, number four and number five, really Willie Mays, probably between him and Hank Aaron, I think one of those guys should have won the 63 MVP. Nothing against Sandy Koufax, but I'm not a big fan of when pitchers win the MVP. I mean, they have their own award. It's called the Cy Young. But let's go back to just kind of talking about Hank Aaron and Willie Mays this season. Hank Aaron had 201 hits, 44 home runs, 130 RBIs. He had a 319 batting average. And like I said, he had a 9.1 WAR. Let's look at Willie Mays. Willie Mays, that 10.6 WAR, 187 hits, 38 home runs, 103 RBI, and 314 batting average. Now, real quick, going back to Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron had 31 stolen bases that season, too. In my humble opinion, and maybe you guys can agree with me, but I feel like Hank Aaron should have won the 1963 NL MVP. And I don't think he should have been in third. I think he should have been above Groat, a guy that hit six home runs, 73 RBI, batted the same batting average as Hank Aaron, but had 201. What's crazy is they both had the same amount of hits, and they both had the same amount of at-bats. And Groat only had three stolen bases compared to Hank Aaron's 31. Willie Mays had eight. And Hank Aaron also had 78 walks. Groat had 56. Willie Mays had 66. Now, I will discuss Sandy Koufax. Excuse me, be like, well, why? What did his stats look like? Why did he win it? And I mean, he had an amazing season definitely nothing against him on that. But he went 25-5, 1.88 ERA. And let's see, he went, he had 311 innings pitched. He had 306 strikeouts, 58 walks. That's a lot of innings pitched. But just kind of want to throw that up there for debate. Kind of feel like Hank Aaron should have won the MVP in 1963. And the thing about Dick Groh, going back to him, he played for the Pirates, I believe, and he did win a MVP, National League MVP, I think a couple of years before this season. But I just, it kind of baffles me sometimes and how things were done back then. And still it happens now. How you look at these stats and make that decision. And what's crazy is that Hank Aaron only won one MVP in his career. And you're talking about 23 seasons. He won one MVP, and that was in 1957. So you let me know, what do you think? You heard the stats. Hopefully it doesn't confuse you because you hear all these crazy numbers, but I don't get it. All right. Another thing I want to talk about, it's called Walk Me. And I kind of want to discuss the walk, the intentional walk. And my hero, my favorite player growing up, Del Murphy, as you know, if you listen to the show, in 1987, Del Murphy led the NL with 29 intentional walks. This is tied for 27th all time in MLB history. And I think, I'd say most of you guys are familiar with who holds the record. It's Barry Bonds. And he just shattered the record in, let's see, what? It was 2004. He had 120 intentional walks. Now let's look at it this way too. Barry is also 2nd, 3rd, 9th, 13th, 16th, and 20th when you talk about the top 20 all-time players intentional walk record. Is in second place real quick in the numbers that he has compared to Bonds' 120. That guy in second place is Willie McCovey, who had 45 intentional walks, nowhere close to 120, and that was in 1969. Barry Bonds would have 688 career intentional walks, and Albert Pujols is in second with 311, not even half of what Barry Bonds had. Musial is in third with 298, and the great Hank Aaron that I have discussed a couple times on this episode is in fourth with 293. Now, going back to Del Murphy, he would finish his career with 159 career intentional walks. Guys, that is pretty much my show this week. It's a short show, and I'm hoping to get some more guests on. And I want to kind of talk about some of the stuff I've been into this week that I do. I pub things. Sometimes it's baseball related, sometimes it's not. Watched a few movies this week, so I thought I'd give you a little input in what I thought. We rented a few movies that just came out that kind of not really made it in the theater because everything going on. The first movie we watched was the new Trolls movie. The kids liked that. I think they watched it about 3 or 4 times. It's not bad. I don't know if it's necessarily as good as the first one. What did you think, Harrison? Was it as good as the first one? It was better? My son, he's saying it's better. My 7-year-old son sitting next to me, he thought it was better. It's definitely worth a watch. And then I watched the new Star Wars movie. I really liked it. I thought it was not probably going to be as good as it was. I mean, it was good to me. I saw a lot of bad takes from other people on it, but to me, it was worth watching. And then the new movie we watched is the new Impractical Jokers movie. I love the Impractical Jokers show. We've been watching that since it first came on. Just going to let you know, Joe is my favorite. Murr, for some reason, is my son's favorite. I don't know why. Joe's his second, but I think we all like Joe. And I'm not going to lie, though, I was a little disappointed in this movie. Because half of it is like the TV show, and then the other half is it's scripted. And it's set up about this Paula Abdul concert they're going to go to. Paula Abdul actually, they run into her. She recognizes them. It's obviously scripted, this is staged. So she gives them 3 tickets. So there's obviously four Impractical Jokers. So they make the drive down to Florida, Miami, to see the show. But the loser of all the challenges, like in the show, doesn't get to go to the Paula Abdul concert. Yeah, I know. Big loss, right? But the funny thing in the cool incident, or the cool thing about this movie, I guess you could say, is quite a few of the challenges were done in Atlanta. So part of it is filmed in Atlanta. It's okay. I watched it again when my wife watched it, and it was a little bit funnier, I guess, the second time. It's still worth watching, but I was a little disappointed because I really do love everything the Impractical Jokers put out. But I would still suggest that you go and rent those movies, because what else do you have to do? Okay, let me pub some of my friends that have a podcast. And I think most of you guys that probably listen to my podcast are probably familiar with them, because they are just flying by my podcast and others, and they're doing a great job. But that is Mansplained Baseball Elsewhere now. And it is hosted, or co-hosted, however you want to say it, with Emily, Marla, and Ashland. Ashland, I believe that's in next to Ireland. But they're doing a good job. I will give you a warning. Do not let your children listen to the show. You might have to put some earmuffs on. And they've had some really good guests, some cool guests, making me a little jealous. I'm over here with my son, and that's my guest for this week. And they had Jeff Francoeur on this week and some other cool folks, John Boy. This is probably my favorite interview. I follow John Boy's stuff, JOMBOY, John Boy. And I like what he does, but their interview and the conversation actually made me even more interested in the stuff he's doing. So you guys are doing a good job. I know some of them listen to this podcast. I don't know why, but they do. So thank you guys, our gals, ladies over at Mansplained Baseball Elsewhere. They're on Twitter, and they're on Apple and Spotify, just like my show. And before you guys hit the stop button and move on to your next podcast, I want to tell you an interesting little story. And I was going to tell it a couple episodes, and I kind of just totally forgot. And I mentioned on kind of fun facts about me. When I was about 19 years old, I played drums, and I was playing in a band called Pacifico. And I played one of our latest song. We got together and recorded a new song, and I played it on the end of shows going the outro music. But at that time, I was playing drums, and that's all I was really doing. And we used to play shows with the band Skillet. I think some of you guys are familiar with the band Skillet. And they had just come out with their second album at that time. And this was about 2000, the year 2000. And their first drummer, the original drummer, who was a guy, he was leaving the band. So I found out that he was going to be leaving. And we were playing a little festival with Skillet. And I went up and spoke to John, who I've talked to, the lead singer John Cooper, and kind of asked him about it, got his information. This, you know, really before the internet was really the greatest way to communicate. So I got his phone number. I called him later, and he explained to me, he's like, look, we kind of have this girl that is pretty much set to be in the band. She was in a band with Corey, his wife. Corey's in the band too, Skillet. But he's like, if you still want to try out, you can come try out. I was like, of course I do. And at that time, they were out of Memphis, and I lived south of Atlanta in Fayetteville. So I had to make the drive to Memphis, and I did it all in like one day, came back, and I didn't know what I was going to get into. I didn't know what I was supposed to do when I got there. So what I did prepping myself was, and this was on cassette tape, I listened to their first two albums over and over on the way up there, and it's like a 6-hour drive. So I'm listening to the first two Skillet albums, and I'm just trying to memorize everything because I really thought they're going to make me play some of the songs. And they were starting to get into loops and synthesizer keyboards, all this stuff during the second album. The first album was more raw. So I'm getting up there, and I finally get up to it's like I think they're in like a little small church, kind of just a storefront. And I get in there, and they're there. They had a different guitarist at that time too. I can't remember his name, but I think he played on maybe an album or two. So it's John Corey was there. Corey Cooper, John Cooper's wife, who's in the band. She was. They were all really nice. Corey is very nice. And basically, all it consisted of was me jamming with them. So we just jammed around, myself, John, and the guitarist at the time. And then I've never played with a click track. If you don't know what a click track is, it's just a metronome. It keeps the time. And I've always been good with my timing. I'm not really a sloppy drummer, I don't think, at least. And this was my first time playing with the click track. So I put the ears in, and I was so nervous. I was so nervous and kind of intimidated and scared that I didn't tell him that I could barely hear the click track in my ear while we're playing and to turn it up. You know, looking back now, I'm like, dummy, just say something, just turn it up. So I couldn't hear it that great. I was getting off a little bit. And then at one point, I literally dropped my drum, one of the drumsticks, like an idiot. And I'm reaching down, just kind of babbling around, just looking like an idiot, trying to pick up the drumstick when I clearly have a bag next to me with drumsticks just to easily grab. So I'm bumbling around. They look at me like, what is this guy doing? And then it's pretty much over. I listened to all those songs, and I'll tell you this, I did not listen to any more Skillet music on the way back home. But after that, I had a sit down with John, the lead singer, bass player, and we just talked about things, kind of see where my heart was and see where I was at. And I really had a good feeling going away from it. I was like, man, I think I'm going to get this, because what they said to me, I know they had a few other people come in there and audition. They're like, well, you're definitely the most aggressive drummer we've had come in here and audition. And I'm a very hard-hitting drummer. I do not piddle-paddle on the drums. I am just a very hard hitter. And I'm also, when I was kind of playing my days, I didn't like just sitting back there. I'm not the kind of guy that you look up on the stage and the drummer looks like the Rolling Stones drummer, looks like a statue that occasionally moves their arms around and the wrist playing the drums. I wanted to put in a show on. I wanted people to look at me when I was playing drums. Now, granted, a few songs in, you start to get a little tired, a little sweaty. You're like, okay, I'm not so energetic anymore. But I go out of this knowing that the other female who did eventually get the gig and was the first female drummer, not the one they have now, but they had another female drummer. And I really thought I had a good chance, man. I felt good about it. I waited a little while and didn't hear anything. So I finally called John, and he answered, talked to him. He's like, yeah, man, we're going to go with the girl. And I'm not going to lie, I was very disappointed. I was very little sad. So I mentioned that, and I had someone request me tell the story. So I thought I'd tell the story of the time I auditioned for Skillet to be their drummer. Obviously, they've gone on to pretty big things, had some pretty big songs about 10 years ago or so that was all over the radio. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to know what would my life have been had that worked out. But I went back to my band Pacifico. We played a lot. We did a lot of touring. We recorded some, and I'm going to close out the show with a different Pacifico song. That is a song that we recorded back around 2000, 2001. And this song was actually played on an MTV show. I couldn't even tell you what it's called, because it was like a high school drama scripted show that was on for one season. It originally was called The Sausage Factory, which, yes, really lame name. And then it was changed to something else. And MTV on their webpage, the website, had something about where you can send in music, and we'll see if we can play it on TV. And they just so happened to like our music and actually had it played on this TV show in the background of some scenes. And I mean, that's pretty cool, kind of cool accomplishment. Nothing really ever came of the band. We tried to make it, and it's just, you know, we just didn't find that lucky whatever it might have been that we needed to make it. That was back when actually having CDs and touring and everything was totally different. Music would sell. Now it doesn't. You know, it's hard to make a living, and that's what we were trying to do. But this is the song that we had out that was played on a show on MTV. Real quick, if you get a chance, check out bigheadsmedia.com. They have a lot of podcasts, And stick around next week. I'm hoping to have a guest on here soon, working on talking to a few people. So hopefully we'll have that going. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you guys next time. Come around to push me down.